past 8 years now, we've enjoyed a very wonderful, successful, uplifting, inspiring presidency. I'm referring to the presidency of our association. But seriously, folks, sometimes the devil just gets in me, and that's the way. I'm delighted, I'm honored to welcome to our pulpit this morning the president of our association, Reverend Dr. William Sinkford. Really, over the past 7 or 8 years of his presidency, which he will be concluding this coming June at our General Assembly in Salt Lake City, Bill has really done a wonderful, magnificent job of bringing the values and principles of our Unitarian Universalist faith to bear in the public arena, as well as taking good care of our UU family as well. I was just honored and delighted when he chose this, our congregation, to be the place to speak to the Living Wage Initiative that our association is partnering with a number of other organizations around the country to be a part of. Bill, it's wonderful to have you here today. Thanks so much for that.
Thank you so much, Steve, and thank you all for welcoming me here on this Let Justice Roll Living Wage Sunday. I'm particularly grateful that we were able to reschedule this after Mother Nature had a different opinion 2 Sundays ago. And I'm excited to be here because I know that many of my Unitarian Universalist colleagues and many, many, many colleagues from other faith traditions have been preaching and are preaching on this Sunday, on Martin Luther King Sunday and today, about the need to stand with low-wage workers and their families. There are such opportunities before us, for all of us who have been working for justice for so long. And I'm struck by the fact that these times, despite the anxiety present, seem hopeful. In fact, a lot of folks are feeling hope for the first time in a very long time. I was privileged to be traveling in Africa in the 3 weeks following November 4th. And every place we went in the 6 countries we visited, we would be traveling down the street, or just walking, and people would see us, and somehow they knew we were Americans. I don't know. And they would shout, "Obama man, Obama man!" Our political leadership is not just a national phenomenon, it's an international one. And this last week I was in Washington, D.C. for the inauguration. A remarkable time. More so, Steve, is this water for
me?
More so for the sense of community that was present than for any particular event. We were with masses of people, and everyone was looking out for his or her neighbor. There was no pushing or shoving. There was no anger, even when some were turned away from them all. It had the feeling of the beloved community made real in our time. And that's a feeling that I hope to hold on to, and that I hope you can. So it's a time of hope. It's also, as I said, a time of intense anxiety about the economy and about whether our hopes and expectations will come true. We fear disappointment. We fear that progress won't come soon enough or won't come at all, that the economic challenges that we face will overwhelm us. And those anxieties are real in all of our lives. They're real in mine, and I know they are real in yours. Somehow, we need to find a way to move forward together. In Washington, the event that I liked the most was the National Prayer Service, which took place the day after the inauguration. I apologize for my throat. It was fine just a moment. It was held at the National Cathedral, and the President and Vice President and their families were there, sitting about 50 feet away from where I was sitting, as it turned out. And at that service, I've never prayed so hard for national leadership in my entire life. at that service, the Reverend Sharon Watkins, who is my counterpart in the Disciples of Christ denomination, gave the sermon, and she began with a story out of the Native American tradition. It's a the story of a grandfather talking with his grandson. And the grandfather tells the grandson that each of us has two wolves in our spirit. And they're battling all of the time. The grandfather said the first wolf speaks for greed and punishment and speaks out of fear. He said the other wolf speaks out of compassion and love and justice. And he said, you will find these two wolves battling in yourself throughout your life. And the grandfather at that point stood as if to leave, and the grandson said, but grandfather, which wolf wins? And the grandfather turned back to him and said, the wolf that you feed, and turned and left. It's a time where we need to examine our assumptions about how to work for change, because many of the assumptions that we carry no longer hold. Many of us have been in protest mode for a long time, and we've gotten very good at it and very accustomed to it. Now we're actually challenged to be a part of change, to be a part of a new governing coalition, and to develop a new imagination for what justice, equity, and compassion can look like, and how to make them come about. It is not a time for critiquing from the sidelines. We have opportunities and obligations to become part of creative solutions. Many economists and many others are noting there is a real silver lining to our economic crisis. We now know that the old model of an unregulated market is bankrupt, quite literally. And we must re-envision and establish a new economy for our times. The pendulum needs to swing away from that wolf of greed and punishment and fear toward the wolf of compassion, love, and justice. The pendulum needs to swing away from a time when we felt free to use up the earth's resources as if they could forever be replenished, to a time when the pendulum swings toward sustainability, where we are caretakers of the earth, not its users only. It's a big task we have. It's a big task. What I know is that we can't let our anxiety drive us. Anxiety shuts down creativity and hope. We need to make a space in our hearts where our hope can lead us, where our vision and hands-on advocacy, where our practicality and our knowledge can help us actually get things done. Establishing a minimum wage that is closer to a living wage is one critical piece of developing a sound economic policy. The minimum wage sets the floor, the wage floor. Tax policy, income policy, energy policy, investment policy, all of these others are pieces of the creation we must help to make. And as we move from the politics of protest to the politics of power, and that's what we're doing, my friends, we need to understand the complexities we're dealing with, to understand what our expectations of the new administration are, and to acknowledge that the imagination that we need to hold in our hearts is a complex one. Most people remember the 1963 March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom as the occasion where Dr. Martin Luther King gave his famous I Have a Dream address. Most don't remember that a key demand of that march was a national minimum wage that will give all Americans a decent standard of living. Certainly, Dr. King did not dream that the value of the minimum wage would be lower today in real dollars than it was in 1963. But he did dream that, and I quote, one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. On March 18, 1968, just days before his murder, King told striking sanitation workers in Memphis, and I quote, It is criminal to have people working on a full-time basis getting part-time income. He said, quote, "We are tired of working our hands off and laboring every day and not even making a wage adequate for the daily basic necessities of life." As we all know, Dr. King was assassinated on April 4th of that year, 1968, the day after he delivered what would be his final speech, "I've been to the mountaintop in support of those workers." Dr. King never lost hope. He never stopped working for justice. He'd been to the mountaintop. We need to sustain our hope as well, to create our own stone of hope. I recall hearing those words, "stone of hope," from Dr. King as I sat in a crowded hall at the UUA's General Assembly in Hollywood, Florida in June of 1966, listening to him deliver the Ware Lecture. Dr. King decried militarism, economic injustice, and the scourge of racism, the three evils, as he called them. He invoked the words of Jefferson and Lincoln, a call for Americans to live up to the ideals that this country is based upon. And he called for Unitarian Universalists to be a part of that struggle, reminding us when the church is true to its nature, it stands as a moral guardian of the community and of society. And finally, he warned us not to sleep through the revolution. Today, I call upon Unitarian Universalists to honor Dr. King's memory by renewing our commitment to peace and justice, to stay in the struggle and to be part of making change. I know that there will be pushback and backlash every time the circle of equality is widened. But I hew my stone of hope with these words. The moral arc of the universe is long, as Dr. King quoted 19th century Unitarian abolitionist Theodore Parker. The moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends toward justice. Rewarding an honest day's labor with a just living wage is the right thing to do, and advocating for fair compensation is our religious duty. A full-time job should keep you out of poverty, not keep you in it. Today, the minimum wage is set so low that millions of people working full-time on low wages, whether minimum wage or just above the minimum wage, are constantly choosing which necessities to go without, paying rent or buying food, paying for childcare or paying for health care. Now, critics of raising the minimum wage often portray minimum wage workers as teenagers living with their families and working for fun money so that they can go out on Saturday night. In fact, 3 out of 4 minimum wage workers are age 21 or older. 2 out of 3 are women. Most minimum wage workers are women with children. They are healthcare workers, childcare workers, food service workers. And while not the majority, people of color and immigrants make up a disproportionate percentage of minimum wage workers in the United States. Most minimum wage workers are high school graduates. And as for teenagers working in minimum wage jobs, and there are some, most of them are working to save for an ever more expensive college education. The Unitarian Universalist Association of Congregations and the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee are members of the Interfaith Let Justice Roll campaign, a nonpartisan coalition of more than 90 faith, community, labor, and business organizations. Let Justice Roll played a lead role in winning the current federal increase to $6.55 per hour, the first raise in 10 years, and I know that this congregation worked hard in behalf of that change. The minimum wage is scheduled to be raised to $7.25 per hour in this year, in July of this year. But even after that raise to $7.25, it will be far below the minimum wage of 1968. Let Justice Roll Living Wage Campaign has launched the $10 in 2010 campaign to raise the federal minimum wage to $10 an hour in 2010. You need to understand, it would take $10.08 minimum wage now to match the buying power of the minimum wage in 1968. This campaign calls on us only to do what our nation was willing to do 40 years ago. And while $10.10 is still not a living wage, it gets us closer to the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938 that called for a minimum standard of living necessary for, and I quote, health, efficiency, and general well-being of workers. We can't fight poverty with a poverty wage. Poverty rates are higher now than they were in the 1970s, in part due to the eroded value of the minimum wage. And you all know there's been a massive shift of income from the bottom and middle to the top of our economic pyramid over the last several decades. The pay gap between minimum wage workers and CEOs grew nearly 15 times wider between 1980 and 2006. CEOs at big corporations make more in a couple of hours than minimum wage workers make in a year. That's not even counting CEO perks and benefits. Did you see the $1.2 million renovation of the bathroom by John Thain of Merrill Lynch just before Merrill Lynch went belly up and received your and my taxpayers' dollars to help bail them out? We have created a culture that abets the kind of greed which can only be called obscene. And we need to change it. The richest 1% of Americans have increased their share of the nation's income to a level not seen since 1928, the year before the Great Depression. In hard economic times, it's more important than ever for people of faith to stand with low-wage workers and their families. And let me remind you that the minimum wage was not enacted during good times, but during the extremely hard times of the Great Depression. When the federal minimum wage was established in 1938, the unemployment rate stood at 19% in the United States. President Roosevelt saw the minimum wage as, and I quote, an essential part of economic recovery. It would put a floor under workers' wages, alleviate the hardships of inadequate wages, and frankly stimulate the economy and job creation by increasing consumer purchasing power and consumer spending right now. We cannot let the current conversation about rescuing our economy take raising wages off the table. Extensive research refutes the claim that increasing the minimum wage causes increased unemployment and business closures. Numerous states, I believe including this one, Hampshire, raised their minimum wages higher than the federal level during 1997 to 2007, during that stagnation period. At that point, the federal minimum wage was set at $5.15. The results indicate that states that raised their minimum wages above the federal level experienced better employment and better small business growth than states that did not. Our current experience tells us clearly that a poverty living wage does not prevent layoffs, it does not prevent unemployment, and it does not prevent business closures. We need to understand the information that we are being presented with. The former policies are simply not working. The minimum wage sets the wage floor. As Roosevelt and his advisors understood, we have to raise the floor to lift the entire economy. Francis Perkins was Secretary of Labor from 1933 to 1945, the first woman to serve in the presidential cabinet. She accepted the position only after securing Roosevelt's commitment to champion the minimum wage, unemployment insurance, and old age insurance. The Department of Labor is currently located in the Francis Perkins Building in Washington. The time has come to reclaim Perkins' legacy and to build on it. President-elect Barack Obama's choice for Labor Secretary, California Representative Hilda Solis, will help us do that. She's the daughter of two immigrant workers and union members, and she's promised to improve the opportunities for hardworking families as she began her confirmation hearings on Friday. Frances Perkins worked in settlement houses in Philadelphia, New York, and Chicago. She worked closely with Jane Addams, Hull House director, and was a kind of a fellow traveler to Unitarians through most of her life. Unitarian Universalists have been actively supporting justice for working people since the birth of our movement in America. As early as 1838, William Ellery Channing, one of the chief architects of Unitarianism, added his substantial public support to the working man's associations. Yes, that was working man's back then. That were forebearers to our present-day labor unions. Not long after Channing, Theodore Parker began speaking out about economic exploitation and was keenly supportive of the work and vision of utopian communities like Brook Farm, founded by Unitarian ministers. Following in this vein, the great Unitarian minister John Haynes Holmes in New York City argued that individual salvation was impossible without social salvation, the liberation of all people from whatever shackles them. He described poverty and the attendant injustice that perpetuate it as a social crime. We've been involved in supporting a fair minimum wage since the very year the association was formed in 1961. When we passed a resolution in support of an agricultural minimum wage for migrant workers. Ours has been a sustained commitment. That 1961 resolution was followed by over three dozen social justice statements in support of economic justice. During the last Let Justice Roll campaign to raise the minimum wage in 2006 and 2007, thousands of Unitarian Universalists, like many in this sanctuary, I'll warrant, signed letters to Congress, worked on ballot initiatives and legislative campaigns in several states. The UUA sponsored a flagship event with the federal legislation sponsor, Senator Kennedy of Massachusetts, at United First Parish in Quincy, Massachusetts. And many of our congregations are involved in local living wage initiatives and organizing in support of low-wage workers. And at our most recent General Assembly, our delegates passed an action of immediate witness in support of the $10 in 2010 campaign. It reads, in very small part, "Whereas low-wage workers whose labor is often exploited and invisible support others' unearned privilege, be it resolved that the 2008 General Assembly supports the Let Justice Roll Living Wage campaign, urging the 111th Congress in 2009 to raise the federal minimum wage to $10 by 2010. Now I need to deal with a little complexity here. 2010, $10 is higher and sooner than President Barack Obama's platform calling to raise the minimum wage to $9.50 in 2011. But $10 and 10 isn't just a catchy phrase. It's what we believe is required. It will only bring us back to where we were in 1968. But the complexity for us here is, what role should the religious voice play in these policy disputes? Should we be supportive and happy that our new president wants to raise the minimum wage at all, even if it's not to a level where we believe it should be? And it speaks to the role of the religious community, even in these hopeful times in our national environment. You see, the religious community, the progressive religious community particularly, needs to retain the ability to have a prophetic voice for justice. We need to be able both to applaud small steps that are taken in the political realm and continue to hold out that vision of the beloved community, which is where we know we need to go as a united people. Without that prophetic voice for the beloved community, our vision will be too limited as a people, and we will settle for less than we need. It's an exciting time for us in this country, and I'm proud to have had the honor these past 8 years to serve an association that has stood steadfastly on the side of the oppressed. Dr. King believed that the struggle against racism and the struggle for economic justice were inextricably linked. He sustained his commitment to eradicate poverty and racism through his vision, his faith, and his frankly brilliant practical and tactical sense, but he never lost hope. And he would be hopeful today. We saw history made last week in Washington, D.C. I was there, I guarantee you it actually happened. But we need to find a way, not just in the coming few weeks or months, but in the coming years, to feed that wolf within us who speaks for compassion and love and justice, so that our voice, when it's raised in the public square, can help move us all toward the world in which we want to live. In a moment, we're going to be asking you to look again in your orders of service and take out those cards. It's time now for us to hold up the vision of Beloved Community to our political leadership, even a political leadership that most of us love, and say we need to do better than we have even imagined.